Good gracious, I didn't know it was that many people here. Can y'all hear me all right? I was afraid you could. I am Bob Wynn, and I'm an Al-Anon. And I want to thank you for inviting me here. It's been a fine weekend, it really has. I want you to know that I have been comfortably housed, well fed, and the fellowship has been warm and friendly. It really has, and I appreciate everything. Now, I got one complaint to make. I had breakfast this morning with some alcoholics. And they got to. I was enjoying my breakfast. We were having a nice breakfast, you know, and conversation was going pretty good. And then they got to talking about speakers, and they were saying, you know, there's some speakers that speak too damn long. And I'm there. I'm it this morning, you know. And then they kept this conversation up all through my breakfast. And finally, Eddie just looked over and he said, I hope you're through for dinner time, lunchtime. I just got up and left. But I've had a nice time. I really have. And I'm an Al-Anon. And somebody was asking me, you know, I appreciate the kind words by Mickey. We really do. You know, it's like, we just met last night, but it's like we're old friends. We each know, you know. And she said, what could I tell them about you? I said, just tell them I'm an Al-Anon. They'll know the rest. But I do appreciate knowing her, and it's a pleasure. And she's a nice lady. She really is. And I want to, well, I'm going to have to start. She asked me about these pins, you know. I got on my collar here, and I was telling her that they have to do with Al-Anon things that my group has. They give away pins for different advancements you have. These have to do with detachment. And the first pin here, it has to do with detached in self-defense. And I got a small pin. And the next one was I just detached. And I got another medal. And the last one, this was a long ways down the line, I detached with love. And this little pin up here is an Al-Anon butterfly, and my wife gave it to me when I reached a point in Al-Anon and she was no longer considering throwing me out of the house. I could live there. And so Al-Anon has been it's really been a thing for me. It really has. And I talked to, you know, I said my prayers this morning, talked to God, and somebody said, well, he'll direct you. I just hope he doesn't make a monkey out of me this morning, because these are his words. But, you know, I guess I ought to start and tell you what I'm supposed to tell you here. And I got my watch out, Daddy, so I'll be all right. And I came back from World War II. Now, if some of you young people are looking at me, you might think World War I, but it was II. And I wasn't an old man. I was a young fella then. I was 23 years old. And I was looking around. I was still unattached, but I wasn't disinterested. And so I started to going around Memphis. I lived in Memphis. That's where I came home to. I came back to Memphis, and I started to kind of go around some place. And there was a place over at the corner of Bellevue and Union called a Cellar. And the kids used to hang out there some. It's kind of a beer parlor. So. And so I went over there, and sure enough, boy, here comes, this is around Christmas in 1945. And here comes four people out there that I knew. And two of them, one of them was my best friend, and he had married his girlfriend, and they were married. And there was another fella that I knew, his name was Jack. And Jack had a girl with him, and her name was Betty, but they didn't have the last name. And I noticed Betty right away. I mean, she was, oh, man, she had long hair down to her shoulders. And she was just, well, skirts were still popular. And she had the cutest pair of little ankles you ever saw. And the rest of that package was really neat. I mean, it was really neat. And so I didn't call Jack the next day. I dismissed him right away. But I called these other people, and I asked them, I said, you know, I would really like to have a date with that Betty. Could y'all fix me up with it? And they said, we don't know about that. And I said, what's the problem? They said, she's engaged to Jack. I said, oh, hell, I wonder how bad the engagement is. And they didn't know either. And so they said, I tell you what we'll do. They said, we'll have a little get-together over at our house, and you're invited. And I said, that sounds pretty good. So I showed up at the appointed hour, and she was over there. I was there. Jack wasn't there. He hadn't been invited. That's a... Man, this is all right. And so I got around to her, you know, and I got talking to her a little bit and kind of quizzing. She said, I'm engaged. And I said, yeah, I see that little ring. He had a cute little ring on her finger. I said, that's a cute little ring. But I said, you know, if I was going to get engaged to a girl with pretty hands like yours, I would buy a much larger stone. And she didn't pick up on that. She really didn't. She just dismissed it and didn't have much to say to me. But I got a phone number. She was 20 years old. She lived with her mother and father, and she worked downtown at the Bank of Commerce. And so I called her up, and she didn't hang up in my face. So I talked a little while, and I said, how about going to the movie with me? She said, I can't go out with you. I'm engaged. I said, oh, hell. So I keep calling a little bit, and finally she wouldn't go out with me. And I, so I told her, I said, she lived with her mother and father. And I said, how about coming over to your mother and to see you over at your mother and father's house on Sunday afternoon? No harm in that. And she thought about it a little while, and she said, well, okay. So I got to go over there on Sunday afternoon. And that was kind of an opening, so I began to go over there on Sunday afternoon, and she still wouldn't go out with me. And so her mother began to like me. I could see that. She was on my side. And so she invited me to stay for dinner that one night, and I stayed for dinner, and I said, I don't see any harm in us going to a movie. And finally, I convinced her to go to a movie after we had dinner, and she did that, and I got to go to a movie a time or two after that. And to make a long story short, after about 2 months, I noticed that damn ring was gone. And I thought, man, I've got it. Mate, I can just go with her anytime I please. I mean, that was all right. And so I did. And I went with her and went with her, you know, and hell, I was getting toward, I was 24 years old, coming up on 25. I was thinking about getting married, you know, and she, man, I really wasn't. I mentioned this a few times. She didn't even pick up on it, you know. She didn't say a damn thing about it. And finally, the girls would just go with you and go with you and go with you and put you off. Finally, one night I said, when are we going to get married? She said, where is the damn ring? Well, there wasn't any problem. I had money. I had some money in the bank. I had enough money to buy a ring and take a honeymoon, you know, and set up a little housekeeping and things. I wasn't worried about it. So I just had a checkbook. You carry it in your pocket. I just signed the top check. She's downtown. I said, stop by Broadnax tomorrow and pick you out a nice ring. I said, the man who manages that place is a friend of my family. And I said, he'll take that check. He knows us. And so she did. She went down. I was over to the house next night. She had drinks. She said, nice ring. Really was a nice ring. Her mother liked it. My father liked it. And I thought it was pretty. She gave me my checkbook. And I went on home. And I got home. I thought, better balance that checking account. So I got the thing. Started subtracting. When I got through subtracting, she left $18 in that damn account. I got married on credit. And things were good. Things really were good. The only thing wrong was she didn't know how to drink. She didn't drink. She's 20 years, 21 by this time. She didn't drink. And I like to have a little drink once in a while and to party or something. And she didn't know how to do it. She wouldn't do it. So I started to encourage her a little bit. And I would, she just wouldn't drink it. She just let it go, you know. And finally I got a mixed of some sweet little drink and she drank that little bit, you know. And all this is going on over a period of some months, a pretty good while, you know. And I brought a little beer home and she didn't like it. So I finally got her where she drank a little beer and you know, to that's another long story that can be shortened up. I did not know I was such a damn good instructor because, boy, I tell you, she caught on to that thing. And by the time she was in her, a few years down the line, I mean in her 20s, she really knew how to drink. I mean, she wanted to do it all the time. And then I spent the next 15 years trying to help her to slow it down some, to do it right. And she never did catch on to that. Y'all taught her that. But that's the way thing was. You know, we had a nice little family. We had one day she's a rather small girl, and I noticed one day she was getting kind of large, and I didn't know what's going on. And so one night she said, "We need to go to the hospital." I said, "Well, you ain't don't look sick to me." She said, "But we got to get there pretty quick." And we went over there, you know, and they said, "You sit here." And she took us somewhere. And about 2 hours later, they come out with a little girl. I said, "Oh, hell, that's all right." You know, so that happened again. And I was working damn hard trying to feed these people and taking care of things. And I thought, man, we got a boy and a girl. We got our family. We have got our family. We got a boy and a girl. And lo and behold, 8 years later, the same damn thing. Now I begin to know what happens. She begins to get heavy. I know what's going to take place. And I told her, I said, you have got to be more damn careful with this business. I said, I'm having trouble feeding y'all now. And so that was it. We had two boys and a girl. And that was our family, really was. And so we're doing pretty good, you know, and rocking along. And this alcoholism was progressing. It really was. Boy, it was picking up speed like a damn snowball down going downhill, you know. And so one time it just got to bother me. I mean, it really did. It got to bother me bad. And so I came home one night. I worked odd hours, just worked all kinds of hours. And I came home one night about 9 o'clock. And she was sitting drinking, and she wasn't drunk. She was just sitting drinking. I said, "Why don't you wait till I get home?" I said, "I don't mind if you have a drink, but just wait for me." And she said, she insulted me. She said she was 21. She said, "I'm more than 21." She said, "I am of a legal age, and I can drink what I want, when I want, and as much as I want. And you keep your damn nose out of my drinking business." Insulted me in my own house. And so I really was felt that way, you know. And honest to God, I can tell you now that will make a person some sick if you try to manage somebody else's drinking. It did me. Boy, oh boy, it make me sick. I mean, it really did. But I didn't give up on it. I just kept after, you know. I kept after and kept after, and she got kind of belligerent at times. And one time I was sitting in the den, minding my own business, reading the paper, and she had a little discussion, and things got quiet, and she went down the hall, and I looked up. It comes out this way to the door. It goes out in the carport, and all. I'm reading the paper. I'm paying attention to it. I looked up again. She got my clothes in her arms. These are clean clothes on hangers. And she's headed for the door with them. And I, you know, and before I realized what's going to be happening, she threw them out in the yard. And that was my place. I could have got my clothes and put them in my car and left that place. But you think I was going to leave that sick situation? Not me, boy. I got my clothes and carried them back in the house, hung them in the closet, and slept with one eye open all night watching her. I wasn't too sure about her. We didn't have any guns. The NRA doesn't have to protect me. I don't have any guns. They don't have to argue my case. I don't want any. I didn't want any. But we had a mean butcher knife in that place. And I'm telling you what, the sight of blood just, it does something else to me. And even if it's my blood, it's scary. So that's kind of the way this alcoholism thing went. And I was always trying to convince. I told her one time, there was an AA group met up the street not far from us. And I said, why don't you go up there and see what those folks are doing up there on Tuesday night? She said, she knew what they were doing. She said, I will never park my car around one of them damn places, and ever. You will never see it parked there. And so I thought, well, you know, so. But I need to qualify it right quick. A little later down the road, she bought one of them damn Easy Does It stickers and put it on the back bumper of her car, and she parked her car around AA every night for the first 7 years that she went there. She really did. She became a good AA. But that was down the road a ways. And before we got there, she just wouldn't go to AA. And I don't know how alcoholic. She might have been having fun all this time with her drinking. But boy, it wasn't fun for me, I'll tell you for sure. And so, and this night, and I didn't live in a vacuum. I mean, I got my words and all in. I mean, I got them in. You know, the kids, they instinctively knew what was wrong with Mama. Mama was drunk, but when Mama wasn't drinking, she had a good relationship with the kids. She could talk to them, and they understood each other. And when she was drunk, they just didn't bother her. And man, they come to me with something. I said, man, you take your troubles somewhere else. You haven't got any problems. I've got problems. And so they took them to Mama. You know, I didn't have any kind of relationship with the kids. I really didn't. And I came to believe that they were plotting against me because they would spend my money. They knew what was going on in the family. I didn't know anything. I'm an outsider. And I'm supporting these people. And this time that she's getting rid of my clothes, throwing them out of the house, you know, and she's standing telling me, don't you come back. You stay out here. Don't you ever come back in here. And the kids all stand back and holler and say, get him out of here, Mama. Get him out of here. And that's the kind of atmosphere I was living in. Man, I'm telling you what, that was some misery. And so one time I finally convinced her she needed to go to a psychiatrist. She wouldn't go to AA, and I knew a good doctor. I really did. And so I talked to her and talked to her, and she said, hell, I ain't crazy. And I said, well, just go talk to the man. Finally, I convinced her. And she said, make an appointment. I'll go over there. So I did. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, right over on Poplar Street. And I've lived in Memphis all my life, worked there, had a business, friends, everything. But I had to drive her down there. You just couldn't trust her to go there by herself. So 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I drive her down there and park around back of the damn place. And ducked in there, you know, and got a newspaper and put up in front of my face so they couldn't see me. And they took her on in there. This is 1968. And I thought, well, you know, it won't be too bad. I heard these doctors charge you fabulous fee. I don't know if it's $50, $60 an hour or something. I thought, well, hell, 15 or 20 minutes of it would be pretty good. You know, I can take that. And so I stood and watched that clock go around. You know, damn clock went past 30 minutes. And I said, hell, I didn't want it all today. I want to come back sometime. And so I went on around. It got to be an hour. And I thought, God knows I can't stand this. But anyway, the nurse came to the door, and she said, Mr. Wynn, hell, anybody could have heard it for 2 blocks away. And I wondered, what does this character want with me? I said, you know, I guess he wants his damn money. I said, I've got good credit. He can send me a bill, but he wanted to see me. So I went in there, honest to God, when I walked in his place, man, I knew I couldn't afford him. The damn carpet was up to your ankles and the furniture. I said, gee, many crickets. And I went on over there and he said, have a seat. He had a desk and he had a seat over there. I sat down on the edge of the chair. I was scared of him. But he comforted me right quick. He was a smart doctor. Had things all over the wall telling how smart he was and where he graduated from and all these things. And he told me right away, he said, I have found out what y'all's problem is. And I thought, by God, he smelled her breath. But you know what that doctor told me after an hour with that woman? He said, this woman is bored to tears. He said, what you need to do is take her out and show her a good time and buy her a few drinks. I swear to God, that's the truth. So help me. Now, that little session cost me a pretty good little piece of money. And that's what he told me. And this woman, he had been to all kinds of schools. And the only school she went to, the University of Mississippi, just long enough to get her picture in the beauty section. That's all she did. And she left. And she didn't have, you know, but she snuck at him in an hour's time. She snuck at him bad. And I don't know what they said about me, but it didn't sound too good. And I thought, well, I'm not going back to him. That's a damn waste of money. But one time, she just kept drinking. Bad. Alcoholism getting bad. 5 o'clock had long since gone by the board. You know, that used to be a cocktail hour. Cocktail hour is just all the time. And so I called him up one night and I said, Doc, I got to have some help. And I didn't even realize what I was saying. You know, I wasn't thinking about her. I was thinking about me, but I was thinking about putting her somewhere. And so I asked him, I said, I need some help. And he said, what's the matter? I said, my wife just can't stop drinking. I said, she's just drunk all the time. And I need some place to keep. You got anything you can do with it? He said, yeah. He said, he worked over at a hospital called Godly Ramsey. They didn't have a treatment center. They just take you over and dry you out, you know, and they'd give you some shock treatments, so they could give you some insulin treatment, you know, things like that, and you make little things. I don't know what they did over there. But that's the kind of place it was. And so he said, bring her over there, and he said, I'll call ahead, and he said, you have to have $200 to check her in. I thought, hell, that's a bargain. He robbed himself. I'd give him $500 to take her in. But he gave it for $200. So she went over there and she stayed there about a week, you know, and everything's going pretty good at home. It's nice. It's quiet and just nice at home. And so I thought I better go back by there and see them and see if they need some more money. And so I did. I went over there to the place and I asked the lady at the desk, I said, I can let y'all have some more money if you want to keep her a while. That girl told me, she said, Mr. Wynn, your Blue Cross is fine. She said, we're not spending a penny of your money. Your Blue Cross is fine. She said, she's in here for her nerves, and your Blue Cross takes care of everything. And by that time, she was in there for my nerves. And so I kept an eye. She liked it. She really did. She laid up in bed. They didn't make her do anything, and she didn't have to work and do anything. They fed her, and they did whatever they did, and she was all right. And the old doc got the call. After about 3 weeks, he got to where he'd call me on Friday afternoon. And he said, Mr. Wynn, your wife's in pretty good shape. She's healthy. She's eating. And she's just doing fine. You can come down and get her. And I said, Doc, how about keeping her another week? And he said, well, whatever you say. And so he'd keep her. And so it went along pretty good until about the fifth week. And she wanted to get out. She wanted to go shopping. She was a shopper. Good Lord have mercy. And she found out she was locked up in that place. She couldn't get out. And boy, she got hostile. And you know, she called me up. That's the only time she ever called me, when she's in that hospital. She called me up and she said, "I'm ready to get out of this place." And I said, "It hadn't got anything to do with me." I said, "It's between you and the doctor." And we don't talk like this now. We really don't. I apologize for saying this, but this is what was said. And she said, "You son of a bitch, you put me in here, and when I get out, I'm going to kill you." And I'm thinking about a butcher knife. And the old doctor called me that Friday afternoon. He said, "Mr. Wynn," I said, "Doc, no way, not this week, no way." And Chris, I kept her in there 6 weeks. 6 weeks. Boy, she was really dry when she got out of there. And Christmas was coming along. And I thought I better let her out because she needs to come get the kids some Christmas presents and stuff like that. So I let her out. She got her home. And she did. She shopped for a week and got the Christmas tree up, got everything fixed up. Wasn't drinking either. And I thought, man, this is a miracle. She hadn't drank for a week, and she's on her own. And so everybody went to bed Christmas Eve, you know, and everything's all set up. Got up Christmas morning, and Lord have mercy, she had caught up with all that 6 weeks that she'd been in that place. And it was terrible. But I need to tell you, while she was in there, a girl in Memphis was working next to my cousin in an office. And this girl was in AA. And I guess they got to talking, and my cousin told her, said, "She's old to Garlin Rams, and this girl been in AA for a while." And she said, "Hell, if she's over there, she's drying out, you know, she probably was going." So she wrote me a letter, and she said, if alcoholism is your wife's problem, and she ever wants to talk to anybody, you can call me, and I'll come talk to her." This girl broke her anonymity. She did. She wrote me that letter. And she put some AA letter to her in there. And I looked at that letter to her, and before I ever carried it down to the hospital, and I answered the first 40 questions in affirmative for Betty. She was it. And this was her. And I thought, man, she'll look at this stuff, and we will be home. I mean, this will solve our problems. And you can't believe how good life's going to be. And I took that stuff down, and she was still in the hospital, and I took it down and laid in the bed with her. And she took one look at it, and she started tearing that stuff up. And I'd be embarrassed to tell y'all what she's calling me. But I could still hear her carrying on when I was getting on the elevator down the hall. I left. But you know something? Within 3 months of the time that I got that letter, I was in Al-Anon, and I've been in Al-Anon ever since. And Betty was sober in AA, and she stayed sober till she died. That's true. So, you know, God knows, you know, the doctor says that we sometimes just don't need to be so anonymous in our neighborhood or something. And that's what was true in my case. Man, I tell you what, if you say one life, it's all right. And if it's mine, it's really all right. But that's how that went. And she got out of that thing, you know, and one night she was still drinking, you know, and I pleaded with her to call. This girl's name is Kitty Lou. And I'd try to get her to call Kitty Lou. She said, "I don't call." So one night she was feeling pretty good, and I said, "Why don't you let me call this girl?" She said, "You can call any damn body. You call Kitty Lou, you can call any damn body. You can call AA. I don't give a damn who you call. That's permission." And so I called Kitty Lou. So I called Kitty Lou, and she said, she said, "She's drinking." I said, "Yes, yeah, she's drinking a little bit." And she lived in Memphis, and we lived out east of Memphis. And she said, I'll tend to it." So then I wasn't there, but she came out the next day, evidently, and she talked to Betty, and she started taking her to meetings in Memphis. Kitty Lou come out to our house and take Betty back to Memphis and come bring her home and then go back to her home, which is 80-mile round trip every time she did it. And she came every night. And Betty had her own car. She didn't need somebody to drive her anywhere. But that's what Kitty Lou did. I guess Kitty Lou's like me. She didn't trust her. And so anyway, after about, I guess it's about 2 weeks or something like that. Well, during this time, she got to know, Kid Lou would call every night. It's about 6 o'clock before she'd come out. She could, her phone ring and I'd answer and say, Kid Lou's here, wants to talk to you. And after about 2 weeks, Betty got sick of this stuff. And one night I said, here's Kid Lou. She said, the phone rang and she said, if that's Kitty Lou, you can tell her to go to hell. She said, I have got her phone number and if I want to talk to her, I'll call her. But that didn't discourage her. She kept coming. And so she turned Betty Lou. She, in the meantime, she told me one night, she said, why don't you go to, you need to go to Al-Anon. I never heard of Al-Anon. Man, I was up in years and I was 40 something years or 46. I never heard of Al-Anon. And I asked her, I said, Kid Lou, what is Al-Anon? She said, they have closed meetings like AA. And she said, I don't guess she really knew. And she said, it's kind of a self-help program. And I said, oh, hell, Kitty Lou. I said, look how this girl's living. Look how I'm taking care of her. I said, take her on down there and sober up and things will be all right over here. And I wouldn't go. I didn't go. And then Betty came home one time. We were supposed to have people for dinner that night, and she'd been sober 6 weeks, you know, not drinking, and invited some people over to eat. Now, went home, the car's in the driveway, and she ain't in the den, she ain't in the bedroom. I'm searching all around everywhere, and finally I found her passed out on the couch in the living room. I called in people, I said, we're going to have to cancel dinner tonight. I said, I'll let you know, maybe in 6 or 8 months or something happened. I don't know. I really can't tell you. But that is when I came. I knew where it was an Al-Anon meeting. I really did. I had cased the place, knew it was one there, what time it met and what night and everything. But I wasn't going. I just was kind of, I don't know. But anyway, I got in my, one night I couldn't stand it any longer. Honest to God, I mean the pain. The pain was something else. And I mean, I get motivated by pain. You know, pain motivates me. It really does. And I got a little story about motivation. I guess I'll tell you now because it kind of fits in there. But it's about the turtle and the rabbit. Maybe you heard it. It's an old story. But the old rabbit's hopping along and he heard this scratching and crying and carrying on and he gets over there and it's a turtle down in a wagon track. And the turtle is just moaning and groaning and carrying on. He can't get out of the rabbit track. I mean out of the wagon track. And old rabbit said, don't worry, Mr. Turtle. He said, I'll go get a rope and I'll come back and I'll pull you out. So he said, he hopped on off and he's gone a pretty good while. And finally he comes back, finds a piece of rope and comes back and he can't find the turtle. He looks up and down the track and he can't find old turtle anywhere. And he calls out and he says, hey, Mr. Turtle, where are you? And old Turtle calls out, and he's way up on the bank over here, out in there. Old Rabbit said, what in the world happened? The old Turtle said, I heard a wagon coming. and that's what alcoholism did for me, man. I heard the wagon coming. And I got myself on over to Al-Anon, I really did. And I went over to this old house on Boyne Street. Gee. And I won't cut it off. I ain't gonna talk Eddie. I know what Eddie is saying. I'm through. I'm gonna be through on time, Eddie. And anyway, I went to this old house and they directed me into the room and they said, Al-Anon's back there. And I went back there and there's about 20 women back in that Al-Anon meeting. It's all right with me. And so I went back in there and I sat down right quick. I was trying to be inconspicuous. But this gal that was president of it, she noticed me right away. And she says, go in the kitchen and get you a cup of coffee and come on back in here and sit down. And I did. I don't drink coffee at night, but I didn't want to break the rules. I don't want to get thrown out the first night. So I came on back in there and sat down, you know, and they started some kind of meeting. I don't know what they said. I have no idea what they said. But I know one thing. I was wound as tight as an 8-day clock when I got there. And I began to sit there, and they just talked. I don't know about what. I had no idea. But they talked, and by the time they finished that meeting, I was so relaxed, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, I was really relaxed. And I thought, I'll get up and get on out of here. I work in the air traffic center, and I knew it had something to do with my head. And where I work, they don't allow insanity, especially they don't allow documented. And so I didn't want anybody to know me. And so I'm sitting next to the door, and I think, I'm going to get out of this place. And so as soon as the meeting's over, I get up, and I start to the door. And I swear to God, it's about four of those ladies had that door blocked and wouldn't let me out. I didn't understand it. I do today. I really do. I understand it today. You know, it's like somebody said, I don't know, how does this fellowship run? Runs on love. Runs on love. We love each other like you wouldn't believe. And unless you're in it, you wouldn't believe it. You know, you got to be in it to experience it, to know it. And I hadn't been in it. But those people had a love for me that night. And what they were trying to tell me to do was just come back. They just wanted me to come back and tell me that I was going to be all right. And so I went on home, and I laid my head on the pillow. And lo and behold, it was morning when I woke up. And I hadn't slept like that in a long time. I mean, it'd been a long time. And I thought, boy, I'm going back tonight. I really am. And so I did. And I started to go. I mean, I really did. They had Al-Anon. They had five. You could go five nights a week in Memphis. That's where I was. And I got me and them place a list of the groups, and I started to go on five nights a week. And I felt I just needed to be away from my own mind. You know, if my mind would not have jerked me around like it did, I wouldn't have come in. I wouldn't have gone anywhere, but my mind jerked me around and led me in places I didn't want to be in. It was terrible. It really was. And I could go for an hour and come out of there and feel peaceful and everything for an hour or so. And that started me into a love affair with Al-Anon. It's been going on a long time. And That's how it first started. And Betty came, you know, she used to lay in bed and cry. She went to bed this time with the alcohol, and she just laid in bed and cried, and she stayed drunk, and she'd cry. I'd get ready to go to meetings. She said, don't go to the old meeting. She said, I need you at home. I need you at home. And I thought, hell, I can't stay here. I'll be back in an hour and a half. I got to go to the thing. I mean, there's no way I could stay away. And so I did. And I'd always invite her. I'd say, you can come go with me. There's an AA meeting right in the next room. I can't go. You know, I'm drinking and so forth. But I tell you what, she stayed on that little drunk for 3 weeks. And she got up one night. I invited her to go every night time I went. And one night I invited her, and she had her clothes on. She hadn't quit drinking, but she was all right. She went to that meeting. And so she started to go into AA, and I was going down on. And I heard her tell somebody, she said it took her about a week or 10 days to finally get all of it out of her system. But she got it out. And so we started to go into these meetings together. And about this time, I really had become kind of consoled to going by myself. I mean, I was working, the program was pretty good. It kicked in all right. And it was kind of rough to have her to come along, you know. And you get in the car, and it's about 30, 40 minutes of meeting. I sit in the car and drive. She sits over there, and she don't say anything. And I like it like that, you know, because we just take each other's inventory, you know. And that's how that would go. And I didn't want to hear what she had to say, and vice versa. So, but coming home, we'd have the same ride home, and we could talk a little bit. We talk about the meetings or something, you know. What was your subject and all this sort of stuff? And we begin to communicate a little bit on the ride home. Things be pretty good till about noon the next day. Then it hit the fan again, you know. We go back the next night, and that's why we did. We went every night. We really did. And think, you know, I came to this Al-Anon thing, and they really did. They comforted me for a short time. And then they began to tell me things that made me uncomfortable. And these people would sit in this meeting, and they had been there for years. They had been to Al-Anon, and they were happy and contented, and they were all right. And they sit around and talk about it, and they say, man, we are sick people. We are sick people when we get here, you know, and looking straight at me. I'm the new kid on the block, you know, and I don't say anything to them, but I had some damn thoughts. And you know, I'm thinking like, by God, come over to my house and I'll show you some sick people. But I didn't tell them that. And they said, we don't have to go home and defend ourselves. And I thought, man, you don't live over at my house. You defend yourself, you'll get killed over there. And all kind of stuff like this. And they told me all kinds of stuff like this. And God, I had a hard time with it. I really did. I couldn't swallow a lot of this stuff. And I tell you what, I went to Al-Anon. I was really a well man. Now, I was miserable, but I was well. I wasn't sick. And it took them about 3 months to really make me sick. But that's not a bad deal. It really not, because they had a way for me to get well, to feel better. And God, they made me so damn sick. I've been trying to get well since January 1969. That's a long time. But, you know, getting well is all right. It really is. So that's how it went. That's how it went. It really is. And I need to tell you a little bit more about it. She died in 95. That was all right. She loved to shop. Good Lord, she loved to shop. And I don't know if any of y'all have any of this thing like we're going out television. She used to have to go to the stores, but hell, they put it on television. And I'm sitting there one time, and it's hot up in Arkansas, and I'm sitting there, and she's got a chair sitting over there in front of the television. It's kind of a nest-like thing. She got all of a drink and the cigarettes and the magazines and everything, and she ain't on a nest. But the television is turned on to this thing, and I called her a few times, and she didn't answer, and I wonder where she was. You know, I wondered for something. And about that time, the damn guy on television, he says, they're showing rings, pretty nice little rings. And so the guy said, and what did you say your name was? And I hear this little voice comes on and says, my name is Betty. And I thought, my God, where, you know. He says, would you like to have one of these rings? She said, yeah, send me one. And I thought, hell, I don't need it. And it's more than I want to spend anyway. And I got to looking around, and I'm dashing around. And she comes out of the damn bathroom with one of these phones you carry. So help me. I told her, I said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. I said, we're going to get rid of that damn phone right now. And we're going to put one here on the wall where everybody can hear what everybody else is saying. But she loved to shop, you know. And she got sick one time. She got cancer in the lung. And she got real sick, and they operated on that. And then she got went to her brain. She got cancer in the brain. And so it radiated for a while, you know. And we came on back. We lived in Florida in the wintertime. We came on back down there and got there. And so things began to get a little rough, and the arm and the leg wasn't working right, and went to the doctor, and he said, you can't have any more radiation. And she said, if I can't have more radiation, she said, what's going to happen to me? Old doc looked her right straight in the eye, and he said, what you got in your head is going to kill you in about 4 to 6 months. And man, I mean, it was a shock the hell out of me. And she just looked at old doctor like, so what? And she told me, she said, we better get going and carry me by the mall. I got some shopping to do. Well, I tell you what, and boy, did she shop. Good Lord. I wheel over to that mall. She's in a wheelchair, you know, and I'd wheel over here and stuff me over here, and I'm going over. She'd pull me over here. Pull over here. We'd go home with a damn wheelchair loaded with stuff. Just as long. See, we just did that until I couldn't pick her up anymore. Last time, I said, well, I hired a van. They had a medical thing, and they took her over there. And one of my little granddaughters went with her, and she got home that day, and she said, you had to tie her feet onto the damn wheelchair to fall off. And she got home, she told Dory, she said, Dory, come over here and untie my feet. She said, come over here and take these shoes off me. She said, I've been walking all day and my feet are killing me. Oh, man, we had a good time during this 4 months that she lived, you know. And that's the way things went. We just enjoyed life every day, every day, every day. And I'm going to tell you something else. If you're in AA or Al-Anon, you stay in it, because one of these days, life will jump up and kick you in the rear end, and you're going to need the support system that's here. And if you're out there and you're all right and you ain't going to meetings and nobody knows where you are, you ain't going to have that support. But we were going to meetings and we had it. The AAs decided they were going to have a meeting over at our house every Friday night at 7 o'clock, and they showed up in numbers like you wouldn't believe, 18, 20 people. And her 26th birthday was on February the 28th, and there was so damn many people showed up in that little house. They're sitting on the floor and everywhere, you know, and that's the way it went. And what a support system. I mean, what a support system. And the people were there during the day. They'd stop by and see her, you know. And one morning I got up, they gave me a bottle of liquid morphine, and I never had to use it. She knew it was there, and I'd ask her something. I said, you need something? She said, I don't need any of it. She said, God takes care of me. And he really did. And one day I got up in the morning, began to affect her brain, just the tumor. And I got up one morning, she said, you won't believe what I got. And I said, what is that? She said, the cutest little dog you ever saw. I said, where is? She says, right down in the bed. And I just looked and I said, oh, yeah, I went along with it. And so about two or three days later, there was a girl came by to sit with her while I went somewhere in the afternoon. And June's sitting there on the couch. And I got home, and June said, come here, Bobby. Betty was asleep. She said, come here. And I went over and sat down, and she said, Bobby, she said, I don't know where that damn dog went, but she said, I have searched this house high and low. And she said, I didn't let that damn dog out either. She had the dog till she died, and she was happy. She really was. And the last thing I ever asked her one night, I knew she was right close to death, and I asked her, I said, how you feel? She said, I'm all right. I really didn't want to go to bed and leave her. And she said, I'm all right. And I said, do you need some of this pain medicine? She said, I told you that I was all right, and you go to bed. And that's the last thing she ever said to me. And she was all right. She really was. And I'm here to tell you now, that my life is good. My life is good. It really is. You know, when you come down, right down to it, God never intended for me to be miserable. I was a long time. And after Betty and I got into the program, she never wished me any misery. She never did. She just always wished the best for me. And that's the way it's been, and that's the way it's always going to be. I talk to God every day, you know. I used to get up in the morning and say, another damn day. And that's exactly what I had. And I don't do that anymore. Not anymore. I get up in the morning and I thank God for every day that I have here. And it turns out good. It really does. Not every day is perfect, but I make it through the worst of them. And it's just like I just sail through, actually in comfort a lot of times. And I've already, you know, I do this every day, and I don't need much for myself. I really don't. And I ask him more or less for myself. I just ask him to please let me go through this day non-judgmental. You know, I like to judge people. I'm smarter than you are, and I can tell you what you need to do. But it gets me in trouble, you know, and I've learned not to do that. I've learned not to judge people. And I ask him to please give me some patience and some tolerance with other people. Let me be that way with other people. If I can do that, I'm all right. I don't know how you're going to be, but I'm all right if I have some tolerance and a little patience. And these are the things that I need. And I don't need anything else. I really don't. It's like a little great-grandson that I've got, and he's 6 years old. Came Christmas time, he's being raised by his grandmother and his grandfather. And so at Christmas time, his grandmother questioned him. She said, "What, Derek, what you want for Christmas?" And he didn't tell her. And finally, she just pinned him down, and she said, "Derek, I have got to know what you want for Christmas." He said, "Grandmother, I don't want anything." He said, "I have got everything that I want." Now, that kid's 6 years old, and he's even better than I am. I'm just about in that state of mind. I really am just about there, you know. I see my time has run out. And so I'm on quitting. Ray's over there. Ray is my son-in-law over there. I told him, I said, "All that white hair he's got, you know," I said, "Wish you wouldn't tell people that you are my son-in-law." And he told me? He said, "Hell, I got it all after I married into your family." I didn't have much comeback for that. But this has been really a fine weekend. It really has. I have thoroughly enjoyed myself. And I want to thank each and every one of you from the bottom of my heart for having me down here and coming and listening to me. Thank you so much.